and welcome to Alliance Manchester Business School's Original Thinking Podcast. Today's podcast was recorded at our latest Original Thinking lecture. This event series showcases the latest research and original thinking from academic colleagues at Alliance MBS. In this episode, we hear from Yuwang Chen, Professor in Decision Sciences and Business Analytics, as he examines how data-driven knowledge can support decision-making in business and management.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Stuart, for the very kind introduction. Thank you for coming. Also, thanks to those of you who joined online. It's my great pleasure to give a talk today, and the title of my talk is Monitor the Data-Driven Decision-Making. I have been doing research on the technical side and the theoretical side of decision-making and the business analytics for many years. In this talk, I'm trying to make my presentation not technical, introduce my research on a conceptual level. But of course, if you have any questions during my talk, so please feel free to interrupt me. Of course, we have time say, to discuss my research in the Q&A session or after this lecture. So this is the outline of my talk today. So first, I'm going to introduce the content of my research, decision making and the decision analytics from three different aspects. Uncertainty, multiple criteria, knowledge and data-driven decision-making. And then I will briefly summarize the keywords and themes of my research before sharing with you a few real-world examples and projects. I will finish my talk with a few concluding remarks. So decision-making is a part of everyone's life, and we have to make decisions from time to time, often on a daily basis. So for example, you decide to attend my lecture today. You decide to what percent, say you reduce your speed when you see this sign during driving, which product you're going to buy in a supermarket, whether you take a vaccine or not. Some decision-making problems are more important, like vaccination decision-making. Some others less important, such as buying a new soft drink in a supermarket. And so the standard view of decision-making is a process in which a decision maker chooses a course of action among alternatives, very often say many alternatives. And Albert Camus, a Nobel Prize winner in literature, argued that life is a sum of all your choices. And Professor Rob Kinney, a well-known professor in decision making and also a consultant at say, Duke University, and he stated and highlighted decision-making is your primary life skill. And the way you can purposely change your life is through the decisions you make. So in this sense, it's important to study say, decision-making say, techniques. But say, how can we develop say, decision-making skills personally, also for business and management? It's often too important to consider three elements. First of all, the decision-making problem itself, and then objectives and alternatives. You need to formulate the decision-making problem you want to address as precise as possible, and then you define the objectives you want to achieve, such as maximize return in your investment decision-making, and then identify, even create new alternatives. So you have to identify what actions you can potentially take. Business decision-making is much more complex very often, but it's also important to consider these three elements. In the meantime, the quality of decision-making for business and management depends on many factors, such as the availability of information, the quality of information you have, or the alternatives you have. Very often, you also have to make a trade-off between multiple criteria. And in most cases, the decision maker's knowledge and experience play an important role in making quality decisions. Sorry, it's not moving. Again, a technology issue. I'm lucky today.
No, it's just a bit slow.
Okay. In business and management, decision-making can occur at all different levels. And it was reported by IBM years ago, one-third business leaders frequently make decisions based on information they don't have or don't trust. half of business leaders say they don't have access to the information in order to do their jobs. More than half of CEOs think they can do a better job capturing and understanding information in order to make swift decisions. What makes decision-making in business management very challenging? Next, I'm going to explore three characteristics in decision-making or three challenges in decision-making. The first one is uncertainty. Very often, we have to make decisions with a partial knowledge, incomplete information. We have to face uncertain outcomes. What is decision-making under uncertainty? Let's look at a very simple decision-making problem we use in our teaching. Assume you have £1 million in your bank account for investing. You decide to invest your money in the real estate market. Three options for investment: apartment, office, warehouse. The outcome, decision outcome, of course, depends on the uncertain economic condition, but can be estimated using historic data. If the decision is yours, which property are you going to buy? Are you going to buy an office, take a risk of losing money in the worst economic situation in order to achieve the highest possible return of £100,000 for the whole year, or you want to make safe investment? You buy an apartment, which guarantees the minimum return, £13,000. So these simple decision-making problems, uncertain outcomes, can make the process very complicated. That's also why many decision models, techniques, and methods have been developed in the past decades to support decision-making under uncertainty. The second challenge I want to highlight is a multiple criteria. Very often, decision-making problems involve more than one criteria. And if there are only two criteria, for example, we only care about performance and the fuel efficiency in buying a more electric car, we can visualize the process. Assume we have, say, 7 alternative cars for your choice. Their performance and the fuel efficiency can be evaluated by a number scale. So we can say, make the decision. Basically, we have to make a trade-off between these two criteria, performance and the fuel efficiency. The trade-off between these two criteria will determine which car you will buy. But as a rational decision maker, you will never buy car C, because car D and E outperform C on both performance and the fuel efficiency. D is a weak efficient solution, because E is better than D for fuel efficiency while having the same performance. So technically, we can identify these efficient solutions. We can construct the so-called efficient frontier. As a rational decision maker, you will only consider alternatives on the efficient frontier. But in reality, many business decision-making problems involve even more than two criteria. For example, Statista survey US customers care about a set of criteria in buying a new car, including fuel efficiency, safety, price, suitability, and so on. In this sense, in order to support reliable decision-making, we have to find ways of aggregating information from these decision criteria together. How can we do that? So in multiple criteria decision-making, very often we can formulate a decision-making problem as a decision matrix, something like this. In this decision matrix, each element, such as A11, represents the evaluation of an alternative or decision criteria. Often we use average numbers to evaluate the performance of alternatives against decision criteria. But here I want to highlight the same average can come from different distributions of data. We should not underestimate the risk of using average numbers in decision making. The concept, the flaw of average, proposed by an economist in Stanford University, and he highlighted the flaw of averages can distort decisions in many areas. Decision making and plans based on assumptions of average conditions can usually go wrong. And also, see, this cartoon illustrates vividly this grounding statistician who thought the river is 3 feet deep, is safe to ford, had to find out the hard way. So basically, he made a wrong decision based on the average number, the average depth of the river. So many researchers, including myself and also some colleagues in the business school, have been doing research to extend the boundary of decision science in the past years. For example, we construct the so-called iniquity decision matrix to formulate decision-making problems, to better capture distribution of data, to better capture uncertain information, uncertain judgments from decision makers. In decision making, of course, it's important to take into consideration human factors and subject judgment from decision makers. But very often, decision maker may not follow the assumptions of rationality. So the concept of rationality proposed by Herbert Simon, one of the most influential researchers in artificial intelligence and decision science. So the concept highlighted the decision making is often bounded by time, resources, decision makers' knowledge and information. In this sense, on one hand, we have to consider attitudes of decision makers toward uncertainty and risk to formulate their preferences as precise as possible. On the other hand, we have to consider information, objective information, and also knowledge from different sources, aggregate them together to support decision analysis. So in recent years, data-driven decision making is widely recognized as a fundamental in business and management. So generally speaking, the scope of data-driven decision making is to using data to inform decision-making process, to validate actions before your commitment. Also, another coined terminology, decision analytics, has been widely used in recent years in order to emphasize the importance of data analytics in the decision-making process. Sorry, the computer is a bit slow. So the scope of decision analytics obviously is to use structured quantitative data, also using machine learning and AI techniques to promote data-driven and also evidence-based decision-making. All right. So Harvard Business Review published a very interesting article 3 years ago in 2019, which reviews the involvement of decision-making models in business and management. In the past, say for many decades, human judgment is the center processor of business decision-making. And over time, summarized data from different sources are used as input to human judgment. In recent years, AI and machine learning techniques are introduced to the flow of decision making. But the main emphasis of this article is not about using AI machine learning decision making, that emphasized the importance of combining information data and use the data information as inputs to AI machine learning models, further combined with human judgment, making use of human knowledge as well, combine them together to support business decision making. But Gartner is a technology research and consulting company, and they estimate by next year, more than one third of large organizations will have analysts who will practice and facilitate decision intelligence and data-driven decision making. I really like this terminology, decision-centric data and analytics. So how to make use of data and data analytics to support decision making? And of course, the tangible benefits for businesses and for individual decision makers to practice data-driven decision-making. On one hand, the business can improve decision outcomes. On the other hand, they can also improve decision-making process. I really like this quote from the founder of World Economic Forum. In the new world, it's not the big fish, which is the small fish, it's the fast fish, which is the slow fish. So in the context of data-driven decision-making, it means we can make use of data and the knowledge to respond to the dynamic, changing, and the uncertain environment in a fast pace. So theoretically, basically, many researchers in recent years have been exploring the convergence of two research directions. So one side, knowledge-based decision-making. So there are a wide range of techniques and models. So including, say, decision-making with prior knowledge and judgments. So applying, say, knowledge and judgments in an intuitive way, and then knowledge-based intelligence. So such as decision rules, test-based reasoning, multiple criteria decision-making, and Bayesian inference. On the other side, data-driven decision-making. So the main focus is to use machine learning and AI techniques to support decision-making. So the scope of decision analytics is to combine these two research directions together to facilitate knowledge-based and data-driven decision-making, because decision-making in business and management depends on more than data, also needs inputs and interactions with human decision-makers. Also, the pragmatic understanding of the decision context needs inputs from decision-makers. So that's why it's important to combine knowledge and data together to support, say, decision-making in business and say decision making. Okay, so my research, just wanted to use one slide to summarize my research. So my research focuses primarily on the interdisciplinary area of decision sciences and the data analytics. I'm aiming all the time to bridge the gap between theoretical research and business applications. So here I use the machine learning algorithm to generate clusters of my publications. So the keywords of my research identified by the machine learning algorithm include decision making and the model, belief rule base for knowledge representation and the model. And the figures here indicates the number of publications I have produced in the past decade being associated with each keyword. And broadly, as a Turing fellow, my research aligns with the two research themes, more specifically, say inference and learning of data and knowledge. So this one of the themes for the Alan Turing Institute. So the second one, I aim to understand human decision behaviors from using data analytics techniques. So this is my research, cables and themes. And here I'm not going to introduce my theoretical research on inference, learning, and the decision analytics, which can be found from my publications. So next I'm going to introduce very briefly a few of my research and the industry projects. So in this inaugural lecture, I was thinking it might be interesting to introduce the first project I completed in the business school more than 10 years ago. So the project was funded by EPSRC, and the scope was to develop risk and the decision analysis models in containerized supply chain. On one hand, containerized supply chain plays an important role in global economy, because approximately 90% of world trade moves in shipping containers. On the other hand, containerized supply chain operates in a high risk environment. This chart shows the number of maritime accidents recorded by the UK Maritime Accident Investigation Branch. You can say fire and explosion. Say more than 200 accidents happened between 1998 and 2011. So the risk and the decision analysis model we developed in collaboration with the industry partner, Newport, takes into consideration all the stages of maritime transportation from the supplier side to the import side. We further consider information from practitioners and also quantitative data from different sources in order to evaluate different types of risk. The most challenging part of this project was to design interpret the model of aggregating data, information, and knowledge from different sources together in order to prioritize risks and then support decision makers on risk mitigation strategies. That was the most difficult part for the project. The second project I completed in the business school was a bit more technical. So the aim, the focus of the project was to develop interpreter models to formulate a relationship between data and the customer liking for new product development and a new product launch. So the data provided by the industry partner comes from different sources, including survey data from the company, also product clinic data provided by panelists, also experimental data on the physical and the chemical features of different products. So we have to find ways to aggregate information from different sources with different natures, with different skills together in order to support decision making. The decision making problem for this industry project was to identify one project among a large number of 17 prototype products, launch that product to the market in terms of the prediction of consumer likings. And the most challenging part for this project was that the target for prediction is not the average number, it's not the average customer liking score, it's the distribution of customer likings, because consumers can have divided preferences on personal care products. So we could predict the target which was launched to the market at that time. So in the past decade in the business school, I have had opportunities to work with many brilliant colleagues and research collaborators, say in the business school and more widely. So I don't think I have time to introduce all the projects I have completed in the past decade. So next I'm going to very briefly introduce two projects I'm working on right now. So the first project, say I'm working on right now, is to use AI machine learning models to predict substance misuse using analytical testing data and also expert knowledge in the form of decision rules. The prediction is used to provide decision support in the court. AI included, say, an illustrative decision tree model to support the prediction of cocaine usage. So we have a large number of cases. We use, say, the data to train the model. We wanted to predict the substance misuse precisely. So the second project I'm working on is vaccination decision making, which is related to all of us in the past 2 years. So vaccination is widely accepted as the most effective way to protect people against infectious diseases. I'd say vaccines have reduced the number of cases and the number of deaths for many infectious diseases, not completely, but say very significantly. And also data proved COVID-19 vaccines have helped to make the virus much less deadly in this year. As the end of last month, 64% of the world population are fully vaccinated with at least two doses. The vaccination coverage in the UK is considerably higher at 25.7%. In spite of the availability of vaccine, and many people basically opt to refuse vaccines or deny the vaccination process. So generally speaking, there's a high degree of vaccine hesitancy globally. And also, even before the pandemic, vaccine hesitancy was listed as one of the top 10 threats to global health. So vaccine hesitancy is very complex to analyze, I have to say, admit, and also context specific, changing over time basis and vaccines. And many researchers have analyzed vaccination decision making from different aspects, so they identify the main drivers for vaccination decision and also the main barriers, such as the perceived risk of the disease and also the safety of vaccines and social influence and so on. So a number of factors are affecting the people's vaccination decision in this context. So we analysed data published by Public Health England in the past years, two very interesting observations. The first one, we observed very high regional disparities for vaccination coverage across different local authorities in England. And if say we look at data for young kids aged 3, the vaccination coverage in some local authorities are as high as 65%, or some other local authorities as low as 30%. High regional disparities. And also we observed during the pandemic, the flu vaccination coverage increased significantly, especially in the winter of 2020 and 21. And why this happened? What are the determinants of vaccination decision making? We have to understand why you want to design policies or to promote, say, vaccinations. So we have made good efforts to analyze individual vaccination decision making in the framework of multiple criteria decision analysis. We further categorize the impact of social influence through social network analysis. So some simulation-based research demonstrated that the population-level vaccination behavior or vaccination coverage are affected considerably by individual decision makers' beliefs and also judgments on vaccines. Also, it is affected by social influence, including spreading information in social medias through different channels in social communities. So this is the simulation results. We have published the research last year in New York. We further used internal migration data published by Office for National Statistics as a proxy of inter-social influence. So we observed some very interesting patterns as well from the data analytics and the data visualizations. So we can find clusters of local authorities which have relatively high internal migration rate and relatively low vaccination coverage, especially for the metropolitan cities, including Greater Manchester. So with the support of, say, a fund, say, from Turing and Manchester, next we are planning to analyze vaccination-related information in Greater Manchester Care Record database. So we want to look at, say, the data closely in order to understand the vaccination status from individual level to household level to local authority level. So we want to understand what factors and cross-sectional factors might affect people's decision-making in taking vaccines. That's the purpose. Of course, the purpose is to use data analytics to support vaccination policy making. So this is also ongoing research in collaboration with quite a few colleagues, including colleagues from cancer informatics. Okay, three sentences to summarize my talk. So the first, decision making is everywhere, and the many decision making problems in business and management are very challenging to solve. In this sense, knowledge-based and data-driven decision-making is fundamental. Also, there's a very wide scope for academic research in this interdisciplinary research area. At the end of this talk, I really wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you to my colleagues and the doctoral students in the school, external academic and the industry collaborators. Also, relevant funding bodies which provided financial support to my research projects. I also want to say thank you to my family for their love and support. Thank you so much. Thank you for your attention. I hope you find my talk a bit interesting, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Yuvan. Hello, everyone. So now the Q&A session is going to start. And I remember one of your first slides, you had a book title saying, decision-making is a life skill. Yeah, I think you've mastered it really well. Just looking over the past half an hour, you had to make real-time decision-making under uncertainty. And I think staying relaxed as you did goes a long way. So well done. So now, but I want to ask you a question. Is again about decision making, but a much broader, more difficult decision making problem related to your career. So I remember you started off as a postdoc 10 years ago, you mentioned, working on a well-defined project. And then you got promoted to lecturer, senior lecturer, now you're a professor and you're independent and well-respected researcher on your own ranks. So we have a few early career researchers here and online as well, and we have also a number of industrialists. Yeah? So they may not know how academia works, how you go up the ranks. So maybe you can tell the audience how you have managed to solve that decision-making problem. So what was your strategy to go from a well-defined project, an independent researcher, and maybe tell us some of the challenges you had encountered and how you solved
them? Yes, thank you, Richard, for the question. And a simple question, although a very hard question to answer. Yes, I think, say, first of all, you have to think about the decision-making problem itself, as I mentioned it from my slides, and why you decide to work in academia. I think a few things which are very important in my personal academic career development. First of all, you have to convince yourself, okay, having a career in academia is a good choice for you. And then you have to find out information from your colleagues, from more experienced, say, and say researchers in the domain, and understand and how the career life looks like at different stage. And I think secondly, I think say research interest is important. In order to develop yourself to become an independent researcher, you have to form your interest. Your interest will motivate you to explore new territories, come up with new ideas, and then you can really produce high quality publications in your area. And on the other hand, I really enjoy my teaching. I learn a lot from my students, including my doctoral students. I think it's good to some extent we link your teaching and research together, practice so-called research net teaching, and then you can learn from the whole process. I think most importantly for me is collaboration. I think collaboration is the key to academic success. And I benefited a lot from working with say, colleagues, more experienced say, research collaborators outside of the university, industry partners. I know some of them joined say, online today. So I benefited a lot from them and say the ideas, knowledge and alternatives shared by all the research collaborators and say basically, and push me on one hand and also help me to expand my research boundary. And as you can say from here, I use my research in quite a few different research areas, including supply chain risk analysis, healthcare, disease support, and so on. Yeah, I think say, it's a long journey to develop say, yourself to become an independent researcher. But I think for me personally, just four things I mentioned really helped me a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm going to go, I will ask, I mean, or we'll feed the questions. I will start with questions in the audience here. And then I will pick a question from one of the online participants and we all connect. Yeah. So do we have any questions in the room? Anyone that wants to ask a question to you? Go ahead, please.
So I want to ask Professor Chen, when you were a student at the university in the early days, did you have the end in mind when you see making you become a professor?
Yes, I like your question. I really enjoy like your question. Yeah, probably say from undergraduate study, MSc study, no. And say I didn't think I would say want to become a professor at that time. So once I started, say, my PhD supervisor was, say, basically a big figure in the area, and say, a very senior professor in this area. I learned a lot from him, and probably from the second year of my PhD, I decided to stay in academia, and say, for my future career development. Yeah, that's why I think, say, because say, research interest is important, because I was doing something very interesting to me during my PhD. That's why I decided to stay longer, at least till now, in academia. Thank you.
I asked that question because I think Stephen Covey, the American guy, said that you must always have the end in mind, because you never get to the end.
So a follow-on question, but now you're a professor, so there's you can't get any higher, yeah? You think now it's time to go to
university? Yeah, there's something I want to explore. That's why I enjoy working with industry partners, especially solve real world problems and say get real data, because data is the foundation for any sort of data analytics. I really wanted to work on real data rather than artificial data. And say I want to make use of the artificial intelligence, but not artificial data in my research.
Excellent. A question from Hongwei. before we go to the online group.
That's a very, very interesting, insightful presentation. It seems like most of your current research, all the research you presented is about individual decision making. So I just wonder, a lot of decisions are made as a group, collectively. So whether you can share some of your insights in the theoretical background about how people make decisions, or all the theoretical model you have developed can be applied to group decision making, particularly with references to the two types of decision making, knowledge-based and data, evidence-based. Because in knowledge-based decision, group decision making, there could be a lot of conflict and so on. So whether this AI or data-driven decision making actually can solve a lot of those collective decision making problems. So something like that.
Yeah, this is a very insightful question. I say thank you for way. I say group decision making has been a very popular research area in recent years. And say basically many say decision making problems involve a group of decision makers, like say renewable energy. Okay, like Great Manchester, which renewable energy they're going to develop. So we have to get information from, of course, many decision makers. So in the context of multiple criteria of the decision making, first of all, we formulated the decision making problem. Which aspects of the decision making problem should be considered? This is the first thing. And then we have to get inputs from different practitioners, stakeholders, and the decision makers. So from the hierarchical structure I showed on the slide, we could consider one more layer on the top, and then we consider the inputs from different decision makers. You highlight an important feature in group decision-making, and say experts and the decision makers can have conflicting opinions and judgments. So we have to find ways to resolve the conflict and make sure we can reach to some extent the consensus in the decision-making process. That's the challenging part. That's why, say, when we apply machine learning and AI techniques to support decision-making, we have to maintain a kind of interactions between machine and AI models and the human decision makers. Okay, I present the decision making outcome to you first, and then you can provide further information, and then we can say further guide the AI machine learning say, models to make changes. So it involves a very complex say, process, much more complex than the typical multiple criteria decision making problems. Yeah, thank you for the very insightful question.
Excellent. A question from one of the online participants.
Yeah, we've got a question from Louise on Zoom. How do we overcome human resistance to their data being shared, and also to AI and machine learning being used in a way that would reduce the need for human knowledge and skill?
Wow, this is a very say broad topic in this area. And say, I think say, in recent years, we highlight the interoperability and also transparency of AI and machine learning models. So some, of course, some say decision makers or say some individuals are hesitant to share information. In order to promote the use of AI and machine learning models, we have to make sure and say all say the information we collected say from participants, they have their right to know how the information is collected, how the information is used in AI and machine learning models. To some extent, we have to make sure the AI machine learning models or decision support models transparent. We can interpret, first of all, the inputs, data collected from individuals to participants, and also the whole process, how the model is formulated, how data is used in the whole process, and make sure that process is also interpretable. And also the final outcome, we have to make sure we can interpret, especially in healthcare decision support, we have to interpret the decision outcomes to patients. Make sure they understand, okay, why this say this treatment is the best option for the patients. So in this sense, in order to encourage the people say to use AI or decision say support models in practice, we have to make sure the whole process as transparent as possible.
Thank you. Another question from go ahead.
Yeah, so my question is, how do leaders make decisions when the data gives us outputs that are morally or ethically challenging?
Wow, this is even more difficult question for me to answer. Yeah, so ethics, so ethical issues say this, say something we should be say very careful, let's say we deal with different issues. I think actually the whole process, so we talk about the whole structure of the decision making and say data analytics and AI, we have to make sure the whole process to some extent is transparent. And I say we have to make sure, like say, for the Great Manchester Care Record, I take it as an example, all data is fully anonymized. So we have to make sure we follow the regulations and the rules and say something like say GDPR to analyze all the data. And also we have the data management, say platform, we make sure all data is addressed, is analyzed in a kind of a safe environment. So it's, let's say, that's very challenging. So it's a challenging question for all, I think, say, data mining and machine learning say, projects or applications.
Yeah, I think it's interesting for the, less about the ethics of the data necessarily, but more about the decision-making process that an individual makes when presented with that, because we do face that, don't we?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Yeah, I mean, We make recommendations, but the decisions are made by humans at the end, maybe, instead of educating the humans and making decisions.
Yeah, let's say, just to follow up from your insight, that's why we use a different terminology. So I use say different terminology as well, if you notice from my slides. So in certain cases, I use say multiple criteria decision making. In some other cases, I use say multiple criteria decision analysis. We analyze how people behave, we design algorithms to support decision making rather than making decisions for human beings.
Thank you, Yuan, for a great presentation today. And can I take this opportunity to say thank you for being such a nice colleague and mentor to many of us in the school. I wanted to ask you about decision analysis. What do you think is the future of decision analysis as a discipline? Because you talked about decision analytics and data-driven decision making. And when I talk to practitioners, I find that they don't necessarily relate to decision analytics, but they seem to understand and grasp, and they're very interested in data-driven decision making. So in that context, tell us a bit more about the discipline.
Yeah, I can even say you might have say more insight than me on this. I try to answer your question in my say understanding. Yes, the traditional OR basically is there for many decades, right? So in recent years, because of big data and say sensitive big data and AI, so we start to explore basically the intersections between traditional OR and also data analytics and AI. I think say we can make these say two techniques say complement to each other. Yeah, that's why I created that graph to consider the convergence. On one hand, we can benefit from knowledge and the experiences human decision makers have. On the other hand, we should make use of data through AI and machine learning models. So I think say for the whole subject area, I think and say in my opinion, say using of AI and machine learning and in general say combining decision making data analytics. That's the future. That's something we have to adopt to some extent.
Any questions from the online participants? Catherine, do you have one?
Yes, so we've got a question from Dharminder at Fujitsu. With all decision making, communicating insights in an appropriate way is a challenge, like knowing your audience. What are your suggestions or tips to make this a good experience?
Thank you, Daminda, for your question. Yes, just want to say, yes, communicating the outcomes from AI, especially from AI machine learning models to human decision makers is important. That's why also in recent years, and also it's reflected in my teaching. So dashboards and say data visualization, visual analytics become more and more popular. So other than using AI machine learning models, how we communicate the findings, results effectively to human participants. That's not either, that's very important. Just name a few companies in the market, say like Tableau, Microsoft Power BI, or Amazon Web Service, QuickSight. So the promoter node or the invested node in creating the kind of the platforms for data visualization. So we can make the whole process more interactive. Link back to my teaching and say, because I use SaaS Enterprise Guide, Enterprise Miner and Node. So in my teaching, I don't know if some of you know these tools. So we don't have to write code at all. So whenever you use our AI machine learning model, you just drag a node to the interface, link the node to your data, and then execute the node. Our machine learning model will be used to get the data directly. So the whole process is very interactive. Basically, it's a different flows on the screen. Okay, one click, and then you can get the results. Okay, the results is not something you want to use, and then you try something else. So I think that communicating the outcomes of AI machine learning model is important. And very often we can use different techniques in terms of the interactive process, also data visualizations. And say again, I want to highlight the interactions between machines and the human decision makers. So it's not a one-off situation. Very often you have to make sure we interact with the whole process and between human decision makers and the machines. Also, I mean that back to something we discussed, say, some time ago, we talk about the human-machine teaming, okay? How, say, we use machines and human beings as a team in different, say, decision-making scenario. So that is a very, say, interesting research area. Just want to highlight, say, Belinda, say, it's an assignment industry, then working with the school. We have been discussing this kind of research for a long time.
Maybe a question that connects the Minda's question with your question. So, we know AI and decision support systems, they rely on a lot of data, they rely on good quality data. And also when you make a decision, it depends on the context where the decision is made. Yeah? So there's a big issue, and you touched upon that it was bias, yeah, algorithmic bias and bias in the decision making process, and maybe also bias in the data. So can you tell us maybe about how we can use the methods you presented today and have been working on for the past 10 years or so to address that bias?
Yeah, I mean, like your question, I think this is also a very, very challenging question in the domain. So we have to admit, say, machine learning, AI models are subject to biases. Even human decision makers are subject to, say, biases, human biases. So we cannot avoid biases in AI and machine learning applications. But in certain ways, we can mitigate the biases. So in the first instance, we talk about the data quality, and also we talk about the four V's of big data, or the three, say, M's, making more money. That's the objective for using data analytics in business and management. So in the first instance, in order to mitigate the biases, I think we should get data cleaned and processed, say, as far as we can, and make sure we use, say, good quality data for AI and machine learning models. And say, as they Forbes surveyed many years ago, and say, data scientists very often have to spend, say, 80% of the time to clean the data before we can apply any models. So get data, say, fully prepared and fully pre-processed with a good quality. That's the first thing. And the second thing, we have to make sure, so human developers, basically, AI models are developed by human beings. We should try to minimize the implicit biases from human developers. I think more important, in my opinion, because I've been working on different projects, I think we have to find ways to identify and evaluate the biases. And there, as academics, we can do research. We can design mechanisms, rules, or methods to guide the process of mitigating, say, biases in machine learning and AI in decision support. That's my opinion.
Thank you. One more question from the online people, so we don't have bias towards people in the room. Catherine, any other question?
Yeah, so probably related question from why you here in Manchester. What about if the data isn't good quality? It's not complete or evenly spread to several sources. How can we make a best decision on that unideal data?
I think that's probably a common suggestion, especially when a company or a business say first use, say, data analytics. So regarding this question, I can refer to the standard, say, the cross-industry standard data mining process. So we start from understanding business understanding data preparation, and say we should put more emphasis, especially if the data quality is not good, understand the business environment, and then understand what data the business has, and say try to use data preparation techniques and say data pre-processing techniques to get the data with a good quality as far as we can. If say the data quality is really, really poor, in that case, you have to go back to think about if say like databases should be applied in a more reliable way in the business. So it's not easy. And say, I think this may be more common, especially in small, medium-sized say enterprises. So they don't have the infrastructure to record data. In that case, okay, data started in different places. If they put them together, the quality is not good. So in this case, I think say on one hand, infrastructure, on the other hand, say data preparation. So this is something we can potentially consider in that situation.
Excellent. One last question from the audience. Go ahead.
Do you apply sampling process on your data?
Sorry?
Do you apply any sampling process on your data or you all collect data?
Yeah, of course, in most cases, we have to apply sampling method. And say, even for say our research projects, we apply the sampling method, especially if say we look at the target, the target variable, and say, like say binary target, and say yes or no, okay, how many customers say purchased the product, how many customers didn't purchase? If say only say 1% purchased, okay, you also understand why that 1% purchased certain product. So you have to apply something like that. You cannot say put all the data together. 1% purchased, 99% say who didn't purchase. And then you make a model to predict the outcome. Okay, simply predict none of the customers wanted to purchase. Your model accuracy is 99%, right? In that case, you have to apply something like that. For example, say 1% purchased, including the data, you know, data set for further analysis. Pick up another 2% of customers who didn't purchase, put them together. 1/3, say it's the target you are interested in, choosers, basically not something you're interested in, and then you can further build predictive models. Yeah. Did I answer? Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question. One more question here.
So I was just wondering, because when humans make decisions, it's usually influenced by a lot of biases or emotions. But if we design a machine learning model that minimizes bias, it'd be too different from human decision makers. So if that doesn't resemble how humans usually make decisions, how can we trust?
Yeah, you mentioned say, an important aspect of the human decision making process, and say, we have an expert who sits in front of you, and say, our colleague, say, Professor Nadia, and say, I believe say, he knows much more than me on decision behavior and cognitive biases. So back to the answer I made, say, to Richard's question. So you want to mitigate the biases, either from data, from machine learning, AI models, or from human decision makers. So we can make the process more impactful, right? So we talk about the formulating decision makers' preferences. It's not the one of suggestion. So very often we can use, I can't say, the utility function to formulate decision makers' preferences. If you think the utility function does not reflect the decision makers' preferences precisely, you have to get more information from the decision makers, right? So one of the most popular methods in multiple criteria decision making is an AHP, analytical hierarchical process. So basically we can ask decision makers, like say compare different alternatives or different criteria in an iterative way, and then we can make sure the information, the model formulated, reflect to some extent the decision makers' say preference and also the cognitive thinking.
Thank you. So I think that was it with question time. And again, I want to thank you once again, Ivan, for this brilliant talk and congratulations. I can only echo what Nadia said. You've been a great colleague and you were always happy to do the extra mile with us or with the students. Yeah, I mean, you're very well appreciated and recognized in the school. So thank you once again. And thank you again for all the questions. I'm passing now on to Stuart. He's doing the closing. Yes. No, thank you.
Okay, so yeah, just to reiterate the point from Richard, a big thank you to Yuwang for his sharing his insights with us this evening, to Richard for facilitating a really interesting discussion as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found this episode insightful. For a list of our latest webinars, news, and useful business content, please visit ambs.ac.uk.